Greetings, and welcome to the Economic Update with Jim Allworth. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, January 28, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference over to your Vice President and Branch Manager, Peter Fullerton. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good afternoon. On behalf of all the wealth advisors at Royal Bank Plaza, I'd like to welcome all of you to our RBC Dominion Securities call. Again, my name is Peter Fullerton, Vice President and Branch Manager with RBP 25 Branch in downtown Toronto. And today I have the privilege to introduce our guest speaker, Jim Allworth. Jim is RBC Dominion Securities Investment Strategist and co-chair of RBC Dominion Securities Global Portfolio Advisory Committee, and that's a mouthful. The Global Portfolio Advisory Committee is very crucial to RBC Dominion Securities, and it provides direction on investment policy and the outlook for financial markets to the rest of the firm and to our clients. It's a very, very important role that Jim oversees. Jim's been in the business for five decades, and he has seen a lot of ups and downs, and certainly COVID and the year that we've had is no different to I'm sure other cycles and pandemics and other issues that have occurred over the years. So Jim's going to give us about a 20-minute overview of the markets and the economy and projections, and then I'll come back with a few questions that we often get, and that should wind up the call. So, Jim, over to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Peter. It reminded me, actually, when you get my introduction, being an old-timer, I guess, reminded me when I was a kid, I used to sail in the summers at the National Yacht Club, which was out behind the ballpark in downtown Toronto, and one summer there was a regatta coming up on the weekend, and there had been kind of weird weather for a week, and the fellow and I who were going to go out in our dinghy, our International 14 dinghy, and race, we checked in with this real old guy on the porch, a guy named Tom Turrell, and he was a real sailor. He'd been around a long time, only had one arm, and we asked him what he thought of the weather, and he kind of leaned back and he said, well, he said, I saw this once back in 38. He said, I think there'll be a line squall come out of the northwest, and it'll be a real ripper. It should arrive around 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. And of course, we went and listened to the weatherman, who said no such thing. So we marched out there, and of course, this line squall came along, and it was a ripper, and we were capsized and had to be towed in. I wish I could give forecasts like Tom Turrell did. It was awfully precise, and I know I can't. But what we can do is kind of look at how things are going and get a sense of what the odds tell us about where things should be. And we might as well start with the virus. That's certainly what's on everybody's mind. And let me try and draw a few positives out of the information. One of them is that the virus has largely followed the path that was outlined to us all way back when it began, which was we'd have a big initial surge that would go on for a month or two, and then it would peak and come down in the summer months, and then we should be prepared for a second wave that would arrive in the fall. And by and large, that is what's happened. And while it continues to make a lot of headlines, and they're getting scarier by the day, in fact, over the last few weeks, the number of cases everywhere in the country has come down a long way from where they were 3 or 4 weeks ago. And the number of hospitalizations has now started coming down, and the number of deaths is declining. And, of course, that could turn around tomorrow and go the wrong way. We know that. But so far, it actually is a trend, which is helpful. The other thing that, of course, has happened is that we're no longer where we were a year ago. We're a lot closer to the arrival of vaccines. In fact, they're here. Whereas a year ago, we were having to wait to see whether any vaccine development was going to produce a candidate that had any efficacy at all. And we waited that out with fingers crossed, and we now seem to be getting a fair number that look like they might be successful on various fronts. And yes, we've got all these issues of a rollout and getting delivery and all the rest of it, I understand, but that's far different from where we were back in March or April. In the intervening time, the economy has done what it's done. It collapsed in the end of the first quarter and on into the second quarter last year. And that collapse was unlike any other. Recessions have always started in the past by the arrival of tight credit conditions where interest rates become prohibitively high and banks become unwilling to lend. This one arrived because government, by edict, shut the economy down in a matter of just a few days. And it shut down the economies of virtually every developed country at the same time. And so GDP in the second quarter this past year experienced the sharpest decline in history. About 6 weeks after the economy closed, the efforts were made to start reopening it, and those efforts were sufficient enough that the third quarter results, which saw GDP go up a long way, was the sharpest rise in GDP in history. It may have been a sharp rise, but it didn't get us all the way back. And neither did a reasonable fourth quarter, which was announced today in the United States. That's going to take getting back to the high water mark of the economy, where it is as large in total as it was at the peak. That's going to take probably, in our view, till the end of this year. The same for the Canadian economy, both the U.S. economy and Canadian economy looking about the same in that respect. While we're there, I'd say that the U.K. and Europe and Japan will probably be about 2 to 3 quarters behind us in terms of getting back to their old peak. It's also worth pointing out that earnings usually follow the same path as the economy, which they did. They collapsed starting at the end of the first quarter last year and collapsed further in the second quarter. And along with the collapse in earnings came a collapse in CEO confidence. CEOs really didn't know what was happening and said so when they would report their quarterly results. They were quite reticent to give much guidance about where we were headed. But the third quarter brought some optimism back and some certainty back, and they've been much more upbeat ever since. That idea that the economy won't be back to its old peak until the end of the year, and that earnings won't be either back to their old peak until about the end of the year, is a part of the description that describes investor conundrum of the moment, and that is that we know the economy isn't back to its old peak yet, and earnings have a long way still to go, but the market, at least the S&P 500, has been at new highs, and the TSX has crested through new highs as well. And investors are worrying, is the market way ahead of the economy? Is it dangerously ahead of the economy? Might it be so severely overvalued that it's dangerous at this point? And about the time people are worrying about this, we hear people coming out and talking about bubbles, and bubbles are on people's mind. And the sheer unusualness of all this is on people's mind. It's hard to draw conclusions when things are happening in ways they've never happened before. We should, I think, try to come to some conclusion on all those things. The first is that bubbles, in my experience, take a long time to inflate. You can see excesses and imbalances, but to actually get to the point where you have a bubble, which usually means that almost everybody is operating insanely in a way that when the bubble bursts, they shake their heads and say, how could I have fallen for that? I don't think this one meets the standards, and I'll just mention a few things. Yes, the S&P 500 is at a new high, and it's at a multiple, a PE multiple, a price-earnings multiple that most people would regard as being kind of expensive. It's about 22 times this year's expected earnings. And people keep hearing about individual stocks, especially some of these large tech stocks, which have been rolling along, the Teslas of the world and Facebooks of the world and Microsofts of the world and so on, which are disturbing to people that these stocks have become so much part of the market. Well, let me draw a few distinctions. The first one is that, yes, the S&P is at a PE multiple of 22, which certainly verges on the expensive by historical standards. It's worth noting that no other market looks like that. That if you looked at the TSX, or if you looked at the European stocks index, or if you looked at the FTSE in London, or the TOPIX in Japan, they're all trading at PE multiples that are slightly above their long-term average. In fact, in the case of the FTSE in London, below their long-term average. So a great many stocks around the world and markets around the world are not experiencing this. And indeed, when you pull the U.S. market apart and take some of those stocks I mentioned out of the mix and look at the PE multiple, it's quite a bit lower than 22 times. So a lot of that excess multiple, if you like, that feeling of expensiveness in the U.S. market is coming from a relatively small number of stocks. Well, is that still dangerous nonetheless? We don't think so for a couple of reasons. One of them is that those stocks that I mentioned are actually leading the way in terms of sales and earnings growth. This isn't a fiction or a fantasy or hoping that something good happens in the future. Their sales are very strong. Their earnings are very strong. So money is flowing, as it very often does, disproportionately towards these companies that are doing the best in this particular environment. And in the process, that's driving their stocks up and making them a larger part of the market. Do they constitute a part of the market that's so large that everything depends on them? Well, not yet. And the last time I looked, if you took the five largest stocks in the S&P 500, those five stocks added up in value to something around 23% or 24% of the value of the market. And I think they've actually come down a little bit from that since I did that. That's still a lot for five or six stocks. But, you know, if you go back to the tech bubble in 2000, one sector, the technology sector, accounted for 50% of the value of the market. Just one sector out of 10 sectors that the market is divided into, technology accounted for half of the value of the market. The same was true in Canada, almost all due to Nortel, by the way. If you go back to the commodity bubble that burst in 1980 after a decade-long rise in prices of minerals and forest products and especially oil and gas, back at the peak of that market in 1980, the five largest oil companies in the United States, the Mobils and the Exxons and so on, accounted for 50% of the value of the market in 1980. Well, we're nowhere close to that in this point. And as I said, it's also true that these stocks that have been moving very well have been doing so, at least in part, because their sales and earnings are doing very well. So I'm not feeling too bubblicious. Now, there's lots of speculation around, and there's lots of initial public offerings around. Most of the ones so far, and a lot of them, have actual track records. In other words, they are real businesses, as opposed to back in the tech bubble. They were very often just a gleam in somebody's eye and a business plan and not really very much to go on beyond that. These ones seem to deserve to be able to come to the market, but there's a lot of them. They do very well after they come out, sometimes doubling in price very quickly. That's sounds like there's speculation in new issues. I think there is. So I think there's frothiness out there. I think that's different than a bubble. And the other bubbles I talked about deflated, not because prices finally got so high that they collapsed under their own weight, or people suddenly woke up and realized the emperor had no clothes on. Rather, they deflated because extremely tight money arrived, and that extreme tight money started to slow down business all across the board and send us into recession, and it's the recession that is what ultimately tore markets apart. And what we see today is a picture where we're coming out of recession and we see no tight credit, far from it. We see extreme low interest rates. We see commitments from central banks to keep them there. The Fed yesterday in minutes revealed, spoke very, very dovishly of what they were looking for. They intend to keep rates low for a long time. They're not going to be fooled by a head fake in inflation. They're going to let inflation run hotter than normal for quite some time. It's going to be a long time, in our view, for either the Federal Reserve or the Bank of Canada start raising rates. And in the absence of tight credit, when we have economies that are reopening and have a long way to go before they're finished reopening, and where we have people who had their incomes bridged and businesses that have had their incomes bridged, and where savings and money in the bank are at record levels, we're inclined to think that this economy has legs and that the market has legs. Now, we work hard at trying to see recessions coming ahead of time, and we have some degree of success in that. Not always. We didn't. I'd be fair to say the kinds of things we typically looked at didn't help you much when the pandemic arrived. But we nonetheless are not going to stop looking at those things, and those things are giving us a green light for the economy. It's also normal. I think you should get a handle on what the trajectory is likely to look like so that we know what we're facing. Usually when you come out of recession, there's a huge rebound. There's pent-up demand, and things really, really rock for a year or so as unemployed people go back to work in fairly large numbers and so on. And a year or a year and a half down the road, a lot of that real juice has been spent. And you kind of settle in to an economy that's growing something in the neighborhood of its long-term potential growth rate, which is usually much slower than that several quarters when it was coming out of recession. Well, we've been in the big rebound out of recession. Maybe there's some more to go as people go back to work, but the economy reopens further and they start feeling safe enough they can spend some of their savings. But at some point, that period is going to be over, and we're going to have a trajectory that becomes more shallow. And it'd be good to know what the long-term potential growth rate of the economy was, what you could expect the economy to settle in at. And for that, I don't think there's any better place to go than the Congressional Budget Office in the United States. Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan department of Congress whose job it is to analyze proposed changes to laws, tax or otherwise, and tell Congress what the likely impact on the economy is. And in the process of doing that, they have always issued long-term forecasts for the American economy under current law, and they do that at least once a year, sometimes more often. And in my experience, their forecasting ability is very, very good. Better, I would say, than most private sector forecasts. And one of the reasons is because they focus on the long term, not the short term. And their expectation for growth for the U.S. economy out over the next number of years, decade at least, is that it's going to grow at between 4 and 4.5% per annum. And I would caution you right away that doesn't include the impact of inflation. In other words, mostly when you and I hear that the economy has grown at something. Like this morning, the U.S. economy in the fourth quarter grew at 4%. That's after taking out the effect of price increases. That's called a real growth rate. This one is not real. We haven't taken out the effect of price increases. They're still in there. And including those price increases, the economy is going to grow at about 4 to 4.5% per annum for the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which, by the way, is about how fast it grew after the financial crisis. But it's very different than how it grew in the 65 years after World War II up to the onset of the financial crisis. Over that period, I guess it's more like 60 years, from 1945 up to 2006-2007, the U.S. economy grew at a little bit better than 6.5% per annum, almost 7% per annum if you didn't take the effect of price increases out of the economy. Ever since the financial crisis, it's only managed to grow at about two-thirds that rate. 4 to 4.5%. There was a feeling around, an understanding in many people's minds, that the reason the economy was growing more slowly after the financial crisis was because of the damage done in the financial crisis, because U.S. households who'd been torn apart by a real estate market that failed had deleveraged, had paid debt down, and got their, and in the process of paying debt down, didn't spend money. They used it to pay off their debts. And so spending grew much more slowly, and the economy grew much more slowly. And there was a general feeling that once Americans were finished with that deleveraging, that the economy would speed back up again. The Congressional Budget Office doesn't think so, and I don't either. So we're going to get growth. We're going to have an expansion. It may well be a long one. It's going to settle in at a rate that's more subdued than what we've had in the last couple of quarters. What does that mean? What is growing at 4 to 4.5% instead of 6.5% as we had after World War II? What does that mean? Well, when the pie is not growing as fast as it used to be, there's more intense competition to maintain your share of the pie. And we're going to see what we saw after the financial crisis, which is very intense competition in virtually every sector. And in that period, as you might imagine, the game is more frequently won by the larger, more well-financed, more successful businesses at the outset. So the bigger are going to get bigger. The small will always be with us and may well actually spawn some companies that can go on to be bigger. But it's the guys in the middle who have the tougher game. They've got to compete against the leaders in their sectors, and that competition can be quite costly. And so we think we're going to see what we saw in the last 10 years, which is more and more corporate concentration in every sector, more and more of that sector being taken by the largest, biggest, most successful businesses. That isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's worth knowing that it's happening. And it kind of sets a standard for what we want to do in portfolios. We think that in that kind of environment, we want to have great conviction that the kinds of companies that we put in our equity portfolios are the kinds of businesses that can grow as fast or faster than the economy. And they can grow their sales faster, they can grow their earnings faster, and their dividends faster. And if we feel confident of that, I think they find their way into portfolio. You know, we know along the way we'll make mistakes on that. We know that some businesses who we put our faith in to do that will fail to live up to it. But if we're not selecting for that at the outset, I think it not only probably guarantees you have performance that's less than it should be, but it also suggests to me you might wind up taking more risk than you want. So I think this focus is going to be on can a company thrive in this highly competitive environment we're talking about. That should be the standard across all sectors. I said that we think and we focus on trying to see bear markets coming ahead of time so that recessions coming ahead of time so that we can see bear markets coming ahead of time. Every bear market has been associated with the U.S. recession. So if you saw a recession coming ahead of time, you'd know to kind of buckle your seatbelts with respect to your equity portfolio and be more defensive. What we know we can't forecast are corrections. Corrections come along out of the blue. They look in the rearview mirror as though you should have seen them coming, but that's really just an illusion in my experience. And I think that one of the ways that I can say that I'm pretty sure of that is that in 52 years now in the business, I have never met anyone who could predict recessions with any consistency in a way that you and I would want to spend time listening to their predictions. Concerns rise, things are pointed out, there's a wall of worry. Every once in a while that wall of worry tips over and the market corrects. I'm sure that is going to go on happening again and again. It would be unusual if we didn't have a correction in the current year. It also, in my mind, would be unusual if we didn't finish the year with markets ahead of where they were at the beginning of the year. If you just think about last year, markets wound up being very close to or higher than they were at the start of the year, and yet the year was filled with drama and economic difficulty and all kinds of issues. But over the span of a year, the market nonetheless managed to eke out some gains. I expect the same is going to be true this year, and I think they'll do more than eke them out. I think they'll be somewhat better than that. Peter, maybe from here would be a good idea to get directed by questions.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. Very insightful. Thank you. One question that comes up quite often is the direction of interest rates, and it's been in the talk in the media recently about a slight rise over the last month or so in interest rates. Where do you see them? Do you think that they're going to continue to move up over the course of the year? Thoughts?
The U.S. 10-year Treasury, I think, at its lows was down at something like around 0.5% or slightly above. It moved up and kind of stabilized in the 60 to 75 basis point range, and then recently has been climbing and got up a few days ago to as high as, I think, 110. Our view is that it's likely to not. It may go as high as 1.5 over the next while, but probably not higher. 1.5 would really just put it into the bottom of the range it was in for a long time before the pandemic began. So we're still really in a period where these are pandemic kind of interest rates, at least in the long term. The short term aren't going to change for the reason I mentioned. Central banks are committed to keeping them low. They want them low. They want to be sure the economy is back on a self-sustaining growth path, and they've already said that they're not going to be spooked by some short-term inflation numbers that they already expect will be higher for a while. So short-term interest rates are going to stay low, and that's going to anchor long-term rates to a certain degree. And we think the most they could go up in terms of the U.S. 10-year Treasury is 10.5. And then 1.5%. And then, if you look at Canada through that lens, and Canadian rates are likely to be somewhat lower than American rates over that stretch. The real question out there is there something or what would provoke you to move above that fairly benign range I've talked about? And the thing would be about of it. Inflation data that the Fed found it couldn't ignore, that instead of, inflation running up and having some high numbers because they're comparing it against weak inflation the prior year and then gradually subsiding as those base effects wore off, if instead of that inflation gets ahead of steam up and starts to be more pernicious and widespread and starts to affect how people are behaving, then eventually the Fed and the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan can't ignore it. And if the Fed can't ignore it and the market realizes that, then we're going to start to see all rates moving higher and risk coming back in because of those high rates or those rates moving to that degree. But we think that's not just a year away, probably more like a year and a half to 2 years away, before it even began. So I think anyone who's counting on substantially higher rates in the short term should not be making that kind of a bet.
Yeah, no, sounds good advice. On another note, with COVID, governments have been printing money left, right, and center. And what effect will that have on all the government debt on the economy?
Well, the debt itself won't have any effect for a long, long time, in our judgment, and I'll go to that in a moment. But printing the money, that is to say, handing that money that the government has borrowed back to individuals and businesses, the danger is, and what people worry about, and what they debate central bank policy around, is they worry that by itself will cause inflation, that too much money produces inflation. If you go back to the guy who won a Nobel Prize on his views on inflation and what caused it, which is the late Milton Friedman, his pithy description of what causes inflation went like this. He says inflation is always, underline always, a case of too much money chasing too few goods. And so what he's saying is it's not sufficient just to have too much money out there. You need to have it in the economy chasing goods that aren't available. That's shown up mostly in the last 15 years in the real estate market, where supply has never been adequate and prices have moved up because there was too much money chasing houses that weren't there and condos that weren't there. But in terms of general goods and services, that hasn't been true. There's been an oversupply, especially on the goods side, because we have this Asian production monster that has gone from being relatively small in the 1990s to gigantic ever since, and we've always had more goods coming at us than we could absorb, and we've had actual deflation in goods. We had some inflation in services, but it was really very well behaved. So you need to be able to see that you're going to have shortages, widespread shortages in both goods and services to get the kind of pernicious inflation that would make the Fed act. And as I said, we think that's some ways off. Now, what about just the debt itself? Well, one of the things you notice right away is that this debt isn't costing very much. Rates are extremely low. Governments and businesses are able to borrow at abnormally low rates. Well, that helps a few ways. One of them is that it means that you can borrow a lot of money, but is your actual cost of servicing that debt going up? Not particularly. And if you go and look in the U.S., you would see that at the federal level, the interest bill of the U.S. government is equal to about 1.75% of GDP. That's up over a number of years from about 1.5%. But, back in the 1980s and the 1990s, the interest bill of the U.S. government was frequently 3 or 3.5% of GDP. We're nowhere even remotely close to that. And in fact, it would take an awful lot more borrowing over the course of this decade to get to the point where it was up to 3% of GDP. And there's no sense particularly saying that they couldn't handle that. Remember, in Canada and the United States, we're not like Greece in the midst of their troubles, where or to Argentina, where, all the government debt is coming due and payable every 90 days or 180 days, and every 180 days they have to go down on their knees to foreigners to bail them out. Government debt in developed countries is termed out a long way. We have debt ranging in maturity all the way from 30 days to 30 years. And the average term of debt in the U.S. and Canada is something in the neighborhood of 7 to 8 years. Which means even if higher rates arrive tomorrow, it would take quite a number of years before it actually fed into the overall interest bill in a substantial way, which is really what I said in another way a moment ago. So we don't see a crisis in the question of how much debt is out there. But the more there is, and the more governments have been able to do it without pain, because people are lining up to buy their bonds and don't require much of an interest rate. The question in all this becomes, when that condition changes, when rates are going up, when you no longer maybe need to borrow that money, are governments actually going to be able to wean themselves off that? And one thing that has happened in the last 30 years is cynicism about government's willingness to be disciplined fiscally. They've got maybe a worse rap than they should have. We had a pretty good period back there when Canada, anyway, brought its debt to GDP down a long way, especially at the federal level. It's also worth pointing out that when this pandemic began, the only country that had a lower federal debt to GDP ratio in the world than Canada was Germany. So we were in pretty good shape when this began. And I'm not ready to assume the cynical outcome. I think governments will ease back on borrowing and get more fiscal discipline as the economy returns to normal. I think politics will demand that, frankly. And I think most people in government are good at counting noses. So I don't see the elements of a crisis in it in the near term. It remains to be seen whether governments behave responsibly, but I think they will.
But Great. Interesting. I've got one more question for you, Jim.
Sure.
Our Canadian economy seems to move in a fair amount of tandem with the U.S. economy, and the U.S. Obviously just moved to a Democratic government over the last week or so. And just your thoughts on the new government and how that might work with or against business.
I think it'll work. You know, this is a very wishy-washy answer, but I think it'll be good for some and bad for others. And I'm not certain that any of that will be dramatic. One of the things we noticed when and we do this exercise, when we, especially when presidential elections are in the offing, is look at what's happened in the past. And one of the things that we've noticed is that there's a tremendous amount of policy continuity, more than you'd think if what you did was judge people's actions by what they'd said they were going to do on the election hustings. And part of that is just practicality. And I'll give you what I think is sort of the outstanding example of the moment. Donald Trump, when he ran in 2016, had a few planks to his platform, drain the swamp and so on. But the biggest one, the one that was talked about most, the one he talked about at rallies, the one that people developed slogans around, was to get rid of Obamacare. And remember that when he was elected, there was a Republican Congress. And Republican senators and Republican members of Congress had joined him on the campaign saying, get rid of Obamacare. And here we are. He's left office. Obamacare hasn't. We still have it. It's getting bigger, not smaller. And it's going to get bigger under Biden, not smaller. But when the rubber hits the road and Republican congressmen and senators involved in the debates of that 2 years to try and bring an end to Obamacare went out and went home on their holidays and talked to constituents, a lot of constituents told them they didn't want them to get rid of Obamacare. And so we got into something where even a Republican majority couldn't do it. Well, I think we'll see many of the same things. I think the fact that there's a tight race in the Senate that is close means that right away a lot of the ultra-progressive, to with quotes around it, thoughts of many of the people who ran for the Democratic nomination are really going to get downplayed. But I think there'll be some things that come through. I think we'll see tax increases on rich people because Biden already knows how they vote and because they're not a big bloc that he has to worry about. And I think we'll see an increased capital gains tax in the United States, and maybe inheritance taxes and things like it. I don't think that's enough to change the economy. And it might very well forestall the political need for the Democratic following to have higher corporate taxes or higher taxes on the middle class, which I think would be certainly a long-term and maybe even a short-term negative. So I think we'll see some things from them. I think the Buy American, you know, is not enough of an issue for us to be a huge thing. I think we can ask for some special dispensation on the neighbor's basis of this and might get some, but I don't think it's going to be a huge thing. And infrastructure spending, to the extent he can get Congress to go for it, and that won't necessarily be a walk in the park, but to the extent he can get Congress to go for it, could be quite good for us.
Great. Jim, as always, I really appreciate your insights and commentary. For everyone on the call, Jim's material is posted quite often on the advisor's website and or sent out to all of you on the email. And if you'd like to receive that or get more, certainly we welcome your contact. Just reach out by email or phone into your advisory team, and we can have that set up for you. That concludes our call for today. I'd like to thank everyone and have a fantastic evening.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jim.
This does conclude the conference for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect.